From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Guantanamo should be closed, and no such place should be created again, or no one should be, stripped of his freedom of rights based on suspicion or based on his background, or, you know, indefinitely detained and abused. And as you see, Guantanamo is still until that day one of the biggest human rights violations in the 21st century.
20 years ago today, the U.S. military began imprisoning Muslim men at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. Over the past two decades, the U.S. has held nearly 800 men at the secretive prison. Most were never charged with a crime. Many were tortured, held in isolation, shackled, hooded, kicked, threatened with dogs. Today, 39 prisoners remain. The U.S. now spends more than $13 million a year for each prisoner at Guantanamo. We'll spend the hour with three men who spent time at Guantanamo, two who were held without charge as prisoners, and one served as a Muslim army chaplain, then jailed himself after being falsely accused of espionage.
So on this January 11th, 2022, let's all agree that it's time to shut this place down once and for all.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The number of people hospitalized with COVID-19 in the United States has soared to its highest level of the pandemic, with over 142,000 patients surpassing even last winter's peak. The grim milestone came as the U.S. reported over 1.4 million new infections Monday, the highest daily case count of any nation so far. Nearly 1,700 U.S. deaths were reported Monday. The crisis has pushed states to mobilize National Guard teams as hospitals delay or cancel elective surgeries, and in some cases impose crisis standards of care. This is New York City emergency room physician Dr. Rahul Sharma.
The majority of patients who are getting admitted are high-risk patients who are unvaccinated or who are elderly, who have comorbidities like cancer, liver, heart failure, underlying respiratory issues, or diabetes. Now, while the disease is milder, it's also much more transmissible.
On Monday, the Biden administration said U.S. insurers must reimburse the cost of up to 8 at-home coronavirus test kits per family member per month beginning on Saturday. In Chicago, schools are back in session today, despite soaring rates of community spread. Chicago's teachers union agreed to return to classrooms after winning an agreement on enhanced COVID-19 testing in schools. In climate news, a new study finds ocean temperatures rose to a new record high last year as atmospheric carbon dioxide levels soared to a new high. This comes as Danish researchers reported Greenland's ice sheet lost more mass in 2021 than it gained for the 25th year in a row. Meanwhile, the insurance reinvestment firm Munich Re reports 2021 was the second most costly year on record, with insured losses from natural disasters totaling around $120 billion. The United Nations has launched a nearly $5 billion aid appeal for international donors to Afghanistan. UN Humanitarian Affairs and Emergency Relief Coordinator Martin Griffiths said without immediate assistance, a full-blown humanitarian catastrophe looms in Afghanistan.
1 million children potentially suffering severe acute malnutrition. 1 million children. The figures are so hard to grasp when they're this kind of size, but 1 million children in Afghanistan at risk of that kind of malnutrition, if these things don't happen, is a shocking one.
In Washington, D.C., the Congressional Progressive Caucus is demanding the Biden administration lift economic sanctions imposed after the Taliban overran Afghanistan in August. The caucus tweeted, if the current U.S. economic policy toward Afghanistan continues, quote, there could be more civilian deaths this year than there were in 20 years of war, they wrote. Delegations from the United States and Russia emerged from negotiations in Geneva Monday with no sign the two sides had narrowed their differences over military tensions in Ukraine. This is Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Ryabkov.
We underscore that for us it's absolutely mandatory to make sure that Ukraine never ever becomes member of NATO.
The Biden administration says some 100,000 Russian troops have massed near Ukraine's border. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman warned Russia Monday if it invades Ukraine, it would face, quote, significant costs and consequences well beyond what they faced in 2014 when Russia invaded and annexed the Crimean Peninsula. South Korea and Japan say they detected a North Korean ballistic missile launch Tuesday, the North's second suspected test in a week. South Korea's military said the missile achieved a velocity more than 10 times the speed of sound before crashing in the ocean between the Korean Peninsula and Japan. Lithuania has paid $113,000 to Abu Zubaydah, the accused 9/11 conspirator who survived CIA torture before his detention in the Guantanamo Bay prison, where he's been indefinitely held since 2006 without charge. In 2018, the European Court of Human Rights ruled Lithuania and Romania violated Zubaydah's rights by allowing the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency to torture him in secret prisons. The court found the countries violated Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions, which requires the humane treatment of prisoners of war. 20 years ago today, the U.S. military began imprisoning Muslim men at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. After headlines, we'll spend the rest of the hour with three men who spent time at Guantanamo, two Muslim prisoners and the Muslim chaplain who himself ended up being imprisoned. Authorities in the Dominican Republic have detained a key suspect in the July assassination of Haitian President Jovenel Moïse. The Associated Press reports Rodolphe Jarre was arrested Friday with the assistance of the U.S. government and is being handled as a U.S. prisoner. Jarre, who is Haitian, had been hiding in Haiti for months and was taken into custody as he attempted to cross into the Dominican Republic. He was previously convicted of drug trafficking and as a former informant for the Drug Enforcement Administration. This comes as new evidence has linked Haitian Prime Minister Ariel Henry with a prime suspect in the Moïse murder. Henry and Joseph Felix Baggio reportedly spoke both before and after Moïse's killing. Baggio is a former Haitian Justice Ministry official wanted on suspicion of organizing the attack against Moïse. Henry claimed power following Moïse's death. He was appointed by Moïse shortly before he was assassinated. Meanwhile, the Institute for Justice and Democracy in Haiti reports three more U.S. deportation flights left Laredo, Texas, Monday morning, expelling 297 Haitian asylum seekers, including 63 children. El Salvador's Supreme Court has reopened a criminal investigation into the 1989 massacre of six Jesuit priests carried out by a U.S.-trained death squad during the Salvadoran Civil War. Their housekeeper and her daughter were also killed. Five of the priests were from Spain, one was Salvadoran. There have been ongoing attempts to prosecute all those involved in the massacre since a 1993 amnesty law was declared unconstitutional in 2016. A Spanish court in 2020 sentenced former Salvadoran colonel Inocente Orlando Montano to 133 years for the killings of the Spanish priests. He's the only person linked to the massacre currently behind bars. President Biden and Vice President Harris are in Georgia today, pressing lawmakers to pass major voting rights legislation. Biden and Harris are touring Atlanta's historic Ebenezer Baptist Church and are paying respects at the crypts of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. and his wife, Coretta. Ahead of the visit, the White House signaled Biden is supporting a special carve-out of the Senate filibuster that would allow a simple majority of senators pass two major voting rights bills that have stalled amidst unanimous Republican opposition. A number of voting rights organizations in Georgia will not be attending today's speeches by Biden and Harris. Cliff Albright, co-founder of Black Voters Matter, told reporters, quote, "We don't need even more photo ops. We need action. And that action is in the form of the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, as well as the Freedom to Vote Act. And we need that immediately," he said. Also, a person who will be absent is the gubernatorial hopeful Stacey Abrams, the most famous of the voting rights activists in Georgia. In North Carolina, a group of voters is challenging the re-election bid of Republican Congressmember Madison Cawthorn, saying his support for rioters who overran the Capitol on January 6 disqualifies him from office. Cawthorn voted against certifying Joe Biden's presidential victory and spoke at the so-called Stop the Steal rally outside the White House last January 6. The 14th Amendment, passed after the Civil War in 1868, bars people from serving in Congress if they've engaged in insurrection or rebellion against the United States or have provided aid or comfort to insurrectionists. The Fox News Channel has promoted the far-right TV personality Jesse Waters to a nightly primetime show. Waters first drew national attention in 2016 with a primetime segment about New York City's Chinatown full of racist anti-Asian stereotypes. Waters came under fire in December after he used violent rhetoric to call on conservative activists to confront top infectious disease expert Dr. Anthony Fauci with conspiracy theories about the origin of the coronavirus pandemic.
Now you're going for the kill shot. The kill shot with an ambush, deadly, because he doesn't see it coming. Boom! He is dead. He is dead. He's done.
After those remarks, Dr. Fauci called on Fox News to fire Waters on the spot. Instead, Fox News announced Monday Waters will host his own show weeknights at 7 p.m. Here in New York, the death toll in Sunday's high-rise apartment fire in the Bronx has been revised downward to 17. Investigators say the fire began when an electric space heater malfunctioned. Victims suffered from severe smoke inhalation after a pair of open doors allowed smoke to spread throughout the 19-story building. City records show tenants of the Twin Parks Tower had complained about a lack of heat in the building and doors that didn't close automatically as required by law. The building did not have fire escapes or sprinklers, and many people became trapped in upper floors where self-closing doors were supposed to have blocked toxic smoke and flames from spreading. In Knoxville, Tennessee, authorities say a fire that burned down a local Planned Parenthood clinic New Year's Eve was arson. The clinic was closed for renovations at the time. The fire was the second attack against the clinic since an evangelical protest group called the Church at Planned Parenthood moved to Knoxville a year ago. Last January, a month after the group's first protest, a person fired a shotgun at the clinic's doors, shattering the glass and peppering the reception area with bullet holes. The gunman has yet to be identified. In medical news, doctors have for the first time successfully transplanted a heart from a genetically modified pig into a human being. David Bennett Sr. of Maryland is responding well after an 8-hour operation Monday. He received a heart from a pig whose genetic makeup was altered to make the organ less likely to be rejected by a human host. Dr. Bartley Griffith led the surgical team.
We've never done this in a human, and I like to think that we have given him a better option than what continuing his therapy would have been. But whether it's a day, week, month, year, I don't know.
Animal rights groups condemn the procedure known as xenotransplantation as unethical and dangerous. People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals said, quote, "Animals aren't tool sheds to be raided, but complex, intelligent human beings. It would be better for them and healthier for humans to leave them alone and seek cures using modern medicine," they said. An investigation by the Washington Post found more than 1,700 United States Congress members enslaved people or were former owners of enslaved people, many of whom served in Washington long after the Civil War ended. The Washington Post researched thousands of historical documents and census records to compile what is the first ever database listing enslavers who served in Congress. And in California, mourners gathered Monday for the funeral of Valentina Orellana Peralta, the 14-year-old girl fatally shot by a Los Angeles police officer in December while she tried on dresses inside a department store dressing room. The Reverend Al Sharpton delivered the eulogy demanding the LAPD be held accountable.
The question is, if 2 days before Christmas, would you have gone into a shopping center in Bel Air, Beverly Hills, and started shooting like that and not consider whether high-end shoppers might be hurt? The fact that the value of a life was not considered is disturbing.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, 20 years ago today, the United States began imprisoning Muslim men at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. Over the past 20 years, the U.S. has held 779 men at the secretive prison. Most were never charged with a crime. Many were tortured, held in isolation, shackled, hooded, kicked, threatened with dogs. When prisoners organized hunger strikes to protest their mistreatment, they were force-fed in a manner described as torture by the United Nations. Today, 39 prisoners remain. Guantanamo opened under the administration of George W. Bush. It continued under Barack Obama, Donald Trump, and now Joe Biden. While Biden has said he wants to close the prison, his administration is making preparations to stay for years. The Pentagon is now building what the New York Times has described as a new secret courtroom at Guantanamo. The Biden administration has so far transferred just one prisoner since Biden took office. On Monday, the Interagency Periodic Review Board recommended the transfer of a Somali man named Guled Sandura, who's been held by the U.S. without charge since 2004 as a so-called high-value detainee. He was held first at a CIA secret black site and then Guantanamo. It remains unclear if he will actually be freed. Over a dozen other Guantanamo prisoners have been recommended for release but remain locked up. The United States is spending an estimated $540 million to keep Guantanamo open. That's over $13 million per prisoner a year. Today, we spend the hour with three men who themselves spent time at Guantanamo. Two were held without charge as prisoners. One, who served as a Muslim army chaplain, was then jailed himself after being falsely accused of espionage. We begin today's show with Moazzam Begg. He's a British citizen who was born and raised in Birmingham, England. In February 2002, Moazzam Begg was seized by the CIA in Islamabad. No reasons were given for his arrest. He was hooded, he was shackled, he was handcuffed and flown to the U.S. detention facility at Kandahar, Afghanistan, then to Bagram Air Base, where he was held for approximately a year before being transferred to Guantanamo Bay. The U.S. government labeled him an enemy combatant. He was never charged with a crime. He was released in 2005. He now works as the director of outreach at CAGE, which advocates on behalf of victims of the so-called war on terror. Moazzam Begg, welcome back to Democracy Now! We first spoke to you in 2006 after you had been released. Can you talk about your reflections today on this 20th anniversary of Guantanamo being opened? And if you wouldn't mind going back, because I'm sure it's painful every time you do, if you can tell us what happened to you there and on the way there when you were held in Afghanistan.
Thank you, Amy. And I do remember very clearly speaking to you first when I came back from Guantanamo. My essential story is, and before I begin this, it's important that I say this, that your report carried a mention of Abu Zubaydah, who was in Albania while he's still in Guantanamo. And why this is important is because the entire torture program, the enhanced interrogation technique program, was developed by the psychiatrist, by the psychologists for him. And it was, of course, justified by the lawyers who said if it's not organ failure or death or severe physical impairment, it's not torture. And that's what opened the torture doors for all of us. So that when I was taken into U.S. custody and I was brutalized both in Kandahar, where I was physically stripped naked, beaten, punched, spat upon, had my photographs taken in this questioned, naked and shivering in the Kandahar desert by FBI and CIA agents, like all the other prisoners were, it was just the beginning. It was the introduction. It was my introduction to not U.S. detention. It was my introduction to the USA. And that's important because the majority of the prisoners had never been to the USA. The majority of the prisoners had the USA come to them and show them a side of the USA that most people in the USA don't even know or didn't even understand exists. And then after Kandahar, I was sent to Bagram. In Bagram, I was held approximately, as you said, for a year. Amongst the worst things I saw was a prisoner called Dilawar. He was a taxi driver. His hands were tied above his head to the top of a cage, and he was physically beaten until he was killed. And I was subjected to the sounds of a woman screaming in the next cell that I was led to believe was my wife being tortured, while FBI and, again, CIA agents, and I emphasize FBI because they are always the ones that kind of get out of being accused of being involved, but the FBI were involved right from the get-go. And they waved pictures of my children in front of my face while I was being tortured, and I heard the sounds of the woman screaming. They threatened to send me to Syria or to Egypt if I didn't cooperate, as they had done to others. So by the time I was sent to Guantanamo and spent the next 2 years in solitary confinement in a windowless cell without any access or any meaningful access to family, to phone calls, to visits, to any of the things that any normal, ordinary, decent, convicted prisoner gets, we had no access to, even though we'd never been charged. And in that state, it was in 2005, eventually, that I was told that I'll be going home. There are no charges against me. So the last 3 years of my life have been all arbitrary. And eventually, as I returned home, I joined my organization, CAGE, and have been campaigning against Guantanamo since that time. So I've been doing this for 15 years. Guantanamo has been open for 20 years. And so the legacy of this place is imprisonment without trial, torture, the absence of the rule of law, the removal of the right of the presumption of innocence. All of those things that people take for granted, people keep saying, well, you couldn't have been in Guantanamo for nothing. There must have been a good reason for it. I said, yes, the reason for it is exactly what Malcolm X said, is that I'm not part of the USA. I'm a victim of the USA, like hundreds of thousands. That's the reason why I was held. And I'm sure the majority of the prisoners will say exactly the same thing.
Well, Guantanamo was spawned as in the aftermath of the invasion of Afghanistan. Now the United States, 20 years after, has pulled out of Afghanistan, ended the war, but Guantanamo remains. Could you talk about the remaining men, the 39 men that are there? They are essentially in three categories of detainees. Could you talk about them, especially the what are called forever prisoners?
Yeah, so these three categories of detainees are really, really strange. And it's important to say this because you did say rightly that Afghanistan, the war is over, where this all began. The war in Iraq is over, yet Guantanamo is still open. In fact, the reason why Afghanistan, the war is over, is because five Taliban, senior Taliban members actually negotiated the withdrawal of the United States and set up the office for the political office for the Islamic Emirate in Qatar. And those former Guantanamo prisoners now are actually ministers in the Afghan government. But getting back to the three categories, one category, of course, is cleared prisoners. So there's about a third of the prisoners, a third of the 39 prisoners, who've actually been cleared for release. Now, some have been cleared for over a decade. What does it mean to be cleared when you've never been charged with a crime to begin with? It's a strange category, but nonetheless, they've been cleared by numerous U.S. Departments, including the Defense Department. But also, you've then got a category of prisoners called forever. Too innocent to charge. Listen to this as the world boggles listening to these terminologies. Too innocent to charge, but too dangerous to release. What does that even mean? And there are people, as you mentioned earlier on, one who was deemed high value is now no longer high value and is now no longer a forever prisoner. And then you've got those who are charged under the military commissions. And the military commissions, for those who don't know, again, has been described by senior jurists around the world as, I quote, a kangaroo court, because there you can have hearsay evidence. You have no right to appeal. Your defenders are not even appointed by you. They're the military. So the military is your judge, jury, and if they have their way, your executioner. But the irony of ironies is this, that after 20 years, not a single person, not even those accused of masterminding the 9/11 attacks, have been convicted for any crime. And as bad as 9/11 may have been, it's not as bad anywhere near. It doesn't even come close to World War II, where in the Nuremberg trials that took place against the Nazis, who architected the entire war, were prosecuted within 1 year. So why can't those people be prosecuted? It's because they were tortured to begin with, and torture evidence cannot be admitted in U.S. courts. That's why they've developed the military commission's legal system, which is outside any systems the United States has ever used before.
But yet, even the military commission system, what has happened there for those who had not been following closely the Guantanamo situation in terms of trying detainees?
So it's all caught up in pre-trial cases, people arguing back and forth whether even the idea can torture evidence even be used? Can a person give evidence for himself? Can he be presented? Because the rules and the regulations are all sort of in the process of development, what's happening is that nobody really knows. There are prosecutors that have resigned. There are judges that have said that we don't even know where the law stands on this. People have said that I never studied this law. When I studied in the U.S. military, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, I didn't study this thing outside of the law. So really what you've got is a black hole of endless pretrial hearings, with lawyers coming and going back and forth, with some people being charged. And the irony, again, is this. Those who've been found guilty under this very low standard of what a crime actually is in the military commissions have gone home. One or two have rather pled guilty, have gone home and had their convictions quashed in their countries of origin. And so those who are yet to face justice or yet to even be charged remain in this limbo, whether it's in the military commissions or outside of it as cleared prisoners or forever prisoners.
You wrote a letter along with our next guest, another prisoner at Guantanamo, Mansour Daifi, and other people who were imprisoned at Guantanamo, to President Biden to close Guantanamo. And in that letter, you talked about some of us had children who were born in our absence and grew up without fathers. Others experienced the pain of learning that our close relatives died back home, waiting in vain for news of our return, waiting in vain for justice. Can you talk about how this affected the families?
Yeah, I mean, just to say that letter was written by a group of us who are all published, we're published authors. And we wrote this letter in the to be published in the New York Review of Books directly and in an open message to Obama, Biden, offering him and describing for him an 8-point plan that we developed that would help him to close Guantanamo. But the effects on people's lives, to get back to your question, is really, you know, one of my closest friends, Shakir Ahmed, was held in Guantanamo for 14 years without charge or trial. He came home to see four children, the youngest of whom was 14 years old, that Shakir had never met in his life. The others were so young when he left them that they barely remembered him, and were grown adults. I spoke recently to a young man called Jawad Rabbani, who's in Pakistan. He's 19 years old. His father is still in Guantanamo. He's cleared for release by the U.S. administration. Jawad has never seen his father in his life. And Jawad's father has never been charged with a crime. This isn't happening with some sort of deepest, darkest country in Asia or Africa that's still developing. This is the most developed nation in the world that has done it to these people, and people will not forget. So the residual effect on people's lives is that people are growing up in the absence, some children in the absence of their parents, their father. Others, like Muhammadu, who's also one of the authors of that letter, his mother died. If you see the film The Mauritanian, one of the most heartbreaking points of that film is when he looks back to see his mother and he never sees her again. He never sees that woman again who gave him life and who brought him up and waited in vain to see him just once. Those type of heartbreaking stories, the cruelty of not even allowing visits or phone calls is just unimaginable, because even the worst offenders around the world don't do this type of inhumanity.
Mozam, we're going to break, and then we're also going to be joined by the Muslim chaplain at Guantanamo. Well, until he himself was imprisoned and charged with espionage. Mozam Beg is with us. He was imprisoned at Guantanamo for 3 years before that, imprisoned in Afghanistan. Director of Outreach now at CAGE in Britain, which advocates on behalf of victims of the so-called war on terror. He was held in extrajudicial detention by the U.S. government from 2002 to 2005. We're also going to be joined by another former prisoner, Mansour Adaifi, who was sent to Serbia. Mozam is the author of Enemy Combatant, My Imprisonment at Guantanamo, Bagram, and Kandahar. Today, 20 years ago, the Guantanamo prison and Cuba was opened by the U.S. military. Stay with us. Andalus Ensemble. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we continue to look at this 20th anniversary of the opening of the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo, it opened 20 years ago today. We're joined now by former Army chaplain Captain James Yee. He was one of the first Muslim chaplains commissioned to the prison in 2002 by the U.S. Army. But less than a year after serving there, he was accused of espionage by the military and faced charges so severe that he was threatened with the death penalty. He was arrested and imprisoned for 76 days in solitary confinement. The military leaked information about the case to the press, and the media went on a feeding frenzy. Chaplain Yee was vilified on the airwaves as a traitor and accused of being a mole inside the army. Then the military's case began to unravel. The charges were eventually reduced and 8 months later dropped altogether. He ultimately received an honorable discharge. Chaplain Yee wrote about his experiences in a book titled For God and Country, Faith and Patriotism Under Fire. James Yee has long called for the closure of Guantanamo, joins us now from his home in Bloomfield, New Jersey. James Yee, welcome back to Democracy Now! We covered your case from the beginning. Why don't you start off by telling your own story, how you came to be at Guantanamo, being a chaplain for the Muslim men who were held there, and then what happened to you?
Great, great. First of all, Amy, Juan, and also to Mansour and Mozam, thanks for having me join you today on the program. But I converted to Islam back in the early 90s. I was already in the military as a graduate of West Point, serving in the Air Defense Artillery as a young lieutenant. And then after converting to Islam, thought I could fulfill a pretty unique role in becoming a chaplain in the U.S. military, because at that time there were no Muslim chaplains in the U.S. military. And I re-entered active duty in early 2001 as a Muslim chaplain. And in the immediate post 9/11 aftermath, I was someone who the U.S. Army Public Affairs looked to handle media requests that dealt with anything that had to do with Muslims who were serving in the U.S. military, especially following the tragic attacks on 9/11, where many of these Muslim service members were experiencing backlash. So my name was out there, not only in U.S. Army Public Affairs, but in the Department of Defense, also the State Department. And so when we started bombarding Afghanistan and opened the prison camp at Guantanamo, I was earmarked for that assignment down in Guantanamo. And I would arrive to the prison camp in early November, almost exactly at the same time that the now infamous Major General Jeffrey Miller took command of the Joint Task Force. And like you said in your intro, I was there for 10 months. I was supposed to have been there 6 months, involuntary extended another 6 months. But at the 10-month mark, then I was secretly arrested.
Well, James G., could you talk about, from your perspective, what Guantanamo represents to the rest of the world and the impact that the treatment of the prisoners there has had in the Muslim world?
So Guantanamo, no doubt, is the international symbol of torture and prisoner abuse, and it continues today to damage the reputation of the United States, and I feel it also damages the relationships that the U.S. has, even with our closest allies. By and large, I don't know of any other nations around the world who are accepting of the U.S. continuing to operate this prison camp in Guantanamo. But in my view, these are very important issues because this has been around for now 20 years. We're at the 20th anniversary of this prison camp. And one of the things I always like to point out is something that the late Colin Powell had stated. And he said that he would close Guantanamo not today, not tomorrow, but this afternoon. So even someone who was part of the Bush administration that opened Guantanamo, from an insider's perspective, even he saw the urgency of Colin Powell of needing to close this prison camp immediately.
And could you talk about the issue that has not gotten a lot of attention, the question of the youthfulness of some of the detainees, basically children? What you know about that?
So during my time in Guantanamo, which was late 2002 through most of 2003, there were actually three young boys from Afghanistan who were brought to Guantanamo during that time, and they were ages 12 to 14 years old. They were termed juvenile enemy combatants. There were already juvenile enemy combatants at Guantanamo, according to the international standard, which would be under the age of 18. So the policy at Guantanamo was that any prisoner who was 15 years old or older were held in general population. And there were several. One that I recall very distinctly was Omar Khadr from Canada, and he was only 15 at the time. But these three younger prisoners were brought to Guantanamo during my time, and they were kept in a separate facility known as Camp Iguana. And I actually used to meet with them on a weekly basis. I had set up some basic sessions and courses on Islam that I would teach, and they had their own translator or interpreter who had a Afghani background that spoke their dialect and language. But they also went through things which I found disturbing. I wasn't privy to witness how they were interrogated, but there were often times when the interrogators came during the time my sessions were taking place, and I was pushed aside. And following those sessions with interrogators, I saw that these young boys actually came back very, very disturbed. They had changed behaviors. They showed signs of anxiety, and they would recall things to me and the other guards that were overseeing their detention. Things like how interrogators would come and they would promise them good, like nice things like ice cream and things like that. But then, for some reason, their punishment was they wouldn't get that ice cream. Now you're talking about very youthful kids, and when you're treating individuals like this who are taken away from their home, taken away from their families, it had to have a devastating effect on their psyche.
James Yee, you're a former U.S. Army captain. You graduated from West Point, a Muslim chaplain at Guantanamo. So if you could finish your story, what happened there? We're talking about a time when, 800 Muslim men almost were being held. And then you had the Muslim, you had Arabic interpreters, you had Arabic language interrogators. Were you chaplain to all of them? And then what happened to you? How did you end up getting imprisoned?
So my role as a chaplain, one was chaplain to the prisoners who were all being held in Guantanamo. This the numbers were upwards towards 660 around the time I was there. One of the things I also make a point of is during that time in 2003, not one could be definitively connected to any terrorist attack or the attacks on 9/11. That wasn't a reality, because anyone who was seriously suspected of being involved in terrorism weren't brought to Guantanamo in 2003. They were put in those secret CIA black sites. And it wasn't only until later, in 2006, when those 19 or so prisoners were brought to Guantanamo after Bush closed down those CIA black sites. But during the time I was there, it was clear that these individuals were not in any way associated with terrorism whatsoever. But my other role as a chaplain was to prisoners, and in that role it was to ensure free exercise of worship and accommodation of religious practices for the prisoners there, and also fielding the complaints and concerns that prisoners had, and thereby providing them with a secondary channel of communication up the chain of command for those concerns and complaints. Then I was a chaplain to the many American Muslims who served on this joint task force, civilian and military. And by and large, most of these individuals were translators or interpreters, linguists. And we actually had a pretty vibrant, what you might call congregation, in which we had the Friday worship service on at the chapel, the Guantanamo chapel, on Fridays. And that even raised suspicion amongst the command at Guantanamo, because we were all under surveillance. I recall seeing individuals who were associated with the FBI that were kind of monitoring our activities at the chapel. And I knew that these individuals were from the FBI, because many of the translators worked for the intelligence operation and said, yeah, these guys who are hanging around the chapel are with the FBI. So that raised suspicion. So there was this widespread Islamophobia or somehow some kind of fear that we as American Muslims who were working for the Joint Task Force were somehow being seditious. And that's how I got targeted as the chaplain, because I was supposedly the ringleader. And after I was arrested, it also came to light that two other American Muslims who were down in Guantanamo working, one a civilian translator and one who was a U.S. Air Force translator, both Arabic linguists. They were also arrested during the time I was, and the media frenzy that you spoke about or you mentioned earlier was that I was the ringleader of some type of spy ring in Guantanamo working on behalf of the, of who knows.
And how long you were held and how you got out?
So I was secretly arrested in September of 2003 for 76 days, held in solitary confinement. I also was subjected to this process called sensory deprivation, where I had the goggles put over my eyes and the ear devices put over my ears to prevent me from hearing or seeing, which instilled fear in me because I had saw how the prisoners at Guantanamo were subjected to sensory deprivation. And for me, this was an indication that I was also being put into this category of enemy combatant, where all of my rights could be stripped away as they were stripped away from all of the prisoners down at Guantanamo. And because I was a U.S. citizen, they put me into what you might call the stateside Guantanamo, which was the consolidated naval brig where President Bush was housing people he categorized as enemy combatants that were either U.S. citizens, and there were two, an individual named Jose Padilla and another named Yasser Hamdi, or an enemy combatant that had been taken into custody on U.S. soil, like Salah Amari, who was in the United States legally and was put also in this prison. And I was housed alongside these individuals. But long story short, all of the charges that were brought against me would eventually fade away. They eventually would, after having absolutely no evidence, even tried to prosecute me on mishandling classified information, in which there was no evidence for that. And so the charges would be dropped. I was released, reinstated as a chaplain, sent back to Fort Lewis, Washington, after which, at the first opportunity, I resigned my commission.
Wow. Well, we're going to break and then come back to our discussion with James Yee, former U.S. Army captain who served as the Muslim chaplain at Guantanamo before the military falsely accused him of spying and imprisoned him. All the charges were dropped. He received an honorable discharge. His book is called Forgotten Country, Faith and Patriotism Under Fire. When we come back, we'll speak to Mansour Daifi, the former Guantanamo prisoner who was held by the U.S. without charge for 14 years before being released in 2016, not to his own country, but to Serbia. He would write a letter from his imprisonment in Guantanamo to the former chaplain, James Yee. Stay with us.
تفهم ما تفهم كل ما أفهم تعرف ما تعرف إني ما أعرف تسأل ما تسأل عني ما تسأل تزعل ما تزعل تاركني أزعل تفهم ما تفهم كل ما أفهم تعرف ما تعرف إني ما أعرف تسأل ما تسأل عني ما تسأل تزعل ما تزعل تاركني أزعل من الأناني من اللي ناس
Tefum by Kabrit. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As we continue to mark the 20th anniversary of the opening of the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo, where there are still 39 men being held at the cost of something like more than $13 million per prisoner poor year that the U.S. taxpayers are paying for. We're joined now by Mansour Daifi, or as he refers to himself, detainee 441. At the age of 18, he left his home in Yemen to do research in Afghanistan. Shortly before he was scheduled to return home, he was kidnapped by Afghan warlords, sold to the CIA for a bounty after the September 11th attacks. He was jailed and tortured in Afghanistan, then transported to the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo in 2002, where he was held without charge for 14 years, many of those years in solitary confinement. In 2016, he was released against his will to Serbia, which he compares to Guantanamo 2.0. He's now the Guantanamo Project Coordinator at CAGE. We first spoke to him last year after he published his memoir, Don't Forget Us Here, Lost and Found at Guantanamo. We spent the hour with him. He's joining us now from Belgrade. Also still with us is Captain, former Army Chaplain at Guantanamo, James Yeh. Mansour wrote a letter to James Yeh when Mansour was still in prison at Guantanamo. Mansour, welcome back to Democracy Now! It's good to have you back with us. Can you briefly tell your story and what you think is important to raise now, 20 years after Guantanamo was open, 20 years to this day?
Thank you, Amy, for having me, and I would like to call you Aunt Amy. You know, I have today an important message for Americans. I wish if George W. Bush and his gang was with us today to have that friendly conversation. You know, what is America? You know, from my perspective, America is not the nuclear arsenal. It's not the military power, economic power. It is a set of values that founded by the founding fathers. So if we just look at the core of the problem, just zoom out, we are dealing for 20 years of war on terror, or war of terror, 20 years of the Guantanamo, 20 years of war anniversary of Afghanistan, will be also 20 years of war in Iraq. Then we are marking also 1 year of riot on the Capitol Hill. The core of the problem is the Republicans, the one who created destruction outside the country, then brought that destruction to within the country. And, you know, we are dealing with the legacy of Republicans now. We are talking what put us all in that position, what put Americans in that position. It is the legacy of the Republicans. And anyone who can destroy America is the Republican themselves. Not any force, not Al-Qaeda, not terrorism, not any force. It is the Republicans themselves, the way they behave, the way they abandoned American morals and values. So basically, if anyone destroys democracy, too, are the Republicans themselves. Because what we are dealing here, it is the legacy of them for the last 20 years. If we look at the 20 years, what happened there, it is the legacy of Republicans. Now we are dealing for 20 years of Guantanamo. You know, those group, I believe, and I recommend the Americans, they should be banned to practice any political for the next 20 years in their strip up their minds. So 20 years now, we are talking about Guantanamo. We are talking about 20 years of indefinite detention, 20 years of torture, 20 years of injustice, 20 years of failure of an abuse to the American justice system. You know, it's not about the detainees. It's not about the place. It's about us as a human being, as humanity. So I'm so sad. You know, we are still talking about closing that detention. And even the Democrats, which actually they always clean the mess of the Republicans, they both played game political with Guantanamo. The Republicans use it for political gain, and the Democrats playing the game of like afraid to close Guantanamo because they're going to be blamed and so on. It needs a decision, a will to close it, and I think Biden can close it. And it's simple, apply justice to Guantanamo.
Mansour, I wanted to ask you not just about the 39 prisoners who still remain in Guantanamo, but the hundreds like you who were never charged and never convicted of any crime and then were sent not back to their home countries, but to a third country that you had no knowledge of before. How has life been like for those men who are, in essence, stateless at this point?
Yes, you know, releasing from Guantanamo is supposed to be a resettlement agreement between the United States government and the hosting countries. And as Chuck Hagel said in his interview in 2017, that Americans, you know, handed the budget for each country and they demanded from rehabilitation and reintegration. That was supposed to happen, but that never happened. When we were released in Guantanamo, some of us were resettled against our will to a countries where we have no knowledge, you know, away from our families, culture, language, and everything. Those countries, you know, when I did my research for my thesis for my university last year about rehabilitation and reintegration of former Guantanamo detainees, I found out there wasn't any kind of rehabilitation and reintegration program. It depend on the hosting countries. These prisoners who relocate in Oman, Qatar, Almania, or Germany, or Irlanda, they are doing well. I mean, those countries actually help them and support them to integrate into the society. But countries like Eastern Europe, Serbia, Albania, Kazakhstan, Senegal, and other countries, people face many difficulties and challenges. Some of them still live in limbo, no legal status. Some of them end up dying, losing their life. Some of them are being threatened to be deported. And some of them actually spend for the last 5 years in the United Arab Emirates, one of the worst cases. After release from Guantanamo to United Arab Emirates, finding themselves spending 5 years, they were released just 2 months ago after they were hospitalized from coronavirus. The United Arab Emirates, they didn't want anyone to die there. So they just shipped them to Yemen without any coordination with their families or government or lawyers or NGOs. And when the released prisoners arrived in Yemen, some of them, in less than 24 hours, they were kidnapped by Houthi and imprisoned for at least 2 months. And we have been working for those cases for the last month. At least 5 of them has been now kidnapped by the militia. And we are trying to free them. We freed, I think, 3 so far because we are working with CASE to track the case, to communicate with our lawyers in the United States, with the ICRC, and they can communicate with the militia in Yemen. So basically, you know, we live in Guantanamo 2.0. No legal status. Some of us cannot travel, live in the stigma of Guantanamo, viewed by the hosting countries as a terrorist, as killers. And we also...
Mossam, I wanted to ask you, we have only about 2 minutes left, but one of the things that many Americans say, well, they weren't convicted, but they were really terrorists. How many of the more than 700 men who were released, to your knowledge, ended up going into some kind of organizations of terrorism or to seek to attack the United States again, from what you can tell?
Or if you could answer that. Mansour, if you could answer that.
Oh, sorry. You know, basically, if you go to the report of Seton Hall University and ACLU, that 86% of the prisoners in Guantanamo were interrogation. George W. Bush himself released like around over 500 prisoners. They found out it was a mistake. Darren Rumsfeld himself, he said most of the detainees in Guantanamo were dirt farmers. I'm talking about the statements by the officials and American institutes. So, when they say like a terrorist, we starved at Guantanamo for justice, asking why we were there. So I was told I was a terrorist at Guantanamo because my behavior within the detention, I wasn't uncooperative. I wasn't because we used to protest for stopping the torture, the hunger strike. That way had that classified as a terrorist. And specifically,
we have 10
about
seconds, Mansour.
In my case, for example, I was sold as Al-Qaeda commander. By 2015, they said, uncle, if he actually joined Al-Qaeda. So basically, there is no basis whatsoever. It just, you know, they try to market their narrative about Guantanamo.
Mansour, we have to leave it there, but I want to encourage people to watch The Hour with Mansour Adaifi, who was imprisoned without charge for 14 years. And thank you so much to James Yee. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Wear a mask. Stay safe.